The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. One of the most thrilling and disturbing shows in New York right now is a play by Anna Deavere Smith called Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. It's about the violence and unrest that erupted after the Rodney King verdict nearly 30 years ago, when police officers who had nearly beaten him to death were acquitted. That act of violence was one of the first examples of police brutality caught on video. Everyone saw it, and it couldn't be unseen. And in the wake of last year's George Floyd uprising, Twilight has taken on an even deeper resonance and meaning in American life. When Twilight premiered on Broadway in 1994, it represented something of a revolution in American theater. Anna Deavere Smith talked to more than 300 people in Los Angeles, people of different races and different perspectives. They discussed everything. They discussed race, the Rodney King beating, and the details of their own lives.
That was the mood at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Safety in numbers. It's like a fortress. And we were just like, here we are, and we're still alive, and we hope that people will be alive when we come out.
If white folks were to experience black sadness, it would be too overwhelming for them. Very few whites could take seriously black sadness and still live the lives that they live in.
Smith relied on those transcripts as the foundation of her work. And hers was a truly novel approach, and it now goes by the name of verbatim theater.
Nighttime to me is like a lack of sun. I don't affiliate darkness with anything negative. I affiliate darkness with what was first, because it was first. And then relative to my complexion, I am a dark individual. And with me stuck in limbo, it's like, I see the darkness as myself, and I see the light as the knowledge and the wisdom of the world and understanding others.
I spoke with Anna Deavere Smith just after the revival opened.
Anna, I thought the production was extraordinary. Extraordinary.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I have to say it was the first time I've been in a theater in so long.
Wow.
Just the act of settling into a seat, mask on, excited to see something that I know is going to be great. Was thrilling.
Well, that's, I guess for me, I've been sitting in that theater at previews and stuff. So I don't even think in the first preview I had that particular sensation, which is a great sensation that a lot of people are having with just being back.
So Anna, let's start at the beginning. This play takes us back to 91, 92, when the LAPD officers beat up Rodney King within an inch of his life and they were finally acquitted. Tell me about your decision to go forward and make theater of this, coming out of a play that you had written about the racial strife in Brooklyn and Crown Heights.
Mm-hmm.
They sound, on the face of it, they sound like projects that are quite similar in intent.
Yeah. Well, in a way, I don't know if they are similar in intent, but they're very connected because I was in at the Public Theater working on Fires in the Mirror. In fact, I was in my, I think, dress rehearsal or something like that. And I got back to my apartment in New York. And when I got home, like my answering machine, remember answering machines was like blinking away. And friends of mine in L.A. were like, you got to turn on your television. We know you've been in tech and you probably don't know about this. It's awful. And just, you know, all of those images of everything in flames. And in fact, the first preview was canceled because I'm sure you were in New York. Then the city kind of shut down out of fear that there would also be a unrest here in New York. So, you know, I went about my business playing that play, Fires in the Mirror. And I really think that one reason it was so popular and it was kind of my breakout thing for my career was that less about people's feelings about Brooklyn, but people were coming to the theater, like with this sense of just unrest about what had happened in LA. How could this happen kind of thing? And so, you know, I went on, left New York, kept running Fires in the Mirror all summer, and went to California, where I lived, in September. I was at Stanford. Actually, that was the year I was coming up for tenure. And every weekend, I would go down to L.A. and just interview up a storm.
Well, and how did you invent your form? Where did it come from? In other words, the Crown Heights piece and then the Los Angeles piece are the result of many, many, many dozens, even hundreds of interviews that you would conduct, transcribe, and then use verbatim. Where does that come from, that technique?
It all started, you know, I don't want to go too far back, but it really started with Shakespeare, with me being more interested in the sort of uncanny thing that could happen to us when I was in the conservatory, when we really just said the words in Shakespeare, as compared to what's called the method or psychological realism, where you should dig deep and find these feelings within yourself, and that idea that every single character in the world lives inside of you. You know, they'd say there's a Hamlet in you. You don't have to reach for Hamlet. He's there in you. And I just thought that was a kind of spiritual dead end. And I, for some reason, being a person who hadn't even intended to be an actor, I wasn't very educated in that way. But I just was looking for another way to think about the craft of acting.
What struck me so powerfully, and there were many things about the play the other night and seeing previous work of yours, is that everybody gets heard and listened to uniquely. And somebody that might turn that might seem to be in the beginning a source of mockery or parody suddenly becomes deeper with time as we listen more and they're given more sympathy. And then the reverse can happen. Somebody who seems to be right on the nose and filled with righteousness, you're not averse to maybe letting a little air out of the balloon there. You're seeing people and trying to make them complex in a very short period of time while they have their say at the lip of the stage, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that's the power of spoken words spoken while people are trying to make sense out of something that doesn't make sense, that has gone awry, and sometimes their own dignity has been disrupted, and they want to restore that. But they're really trying to make order out of disorder, whether that's emotional, whether it's just the catastrophe that they saw or catastrophe that happened to them. And also, very importantly, in the case of Twilight, I had an opportunity to make the race story, which had been at that time pretty much told, even in talking about the Los Angeles riots, as a story about black and white people. And going to L.A. was an opportunity to complicate that because of the fact that Korean businesses were hit, the fact that the riot that started as a social justice riot also became a Latinx poverty riot. I had a chance to make the story of race more complex.
Obviously, that's one of the challenges and one of the sources of power for the production that I was lucky enough to see the other night is the time that's elapsed between the beating of Rodney King and the period of Black Lives Matter and the murder, the torture and murder of George Floyd. How were you thinking about how George Floyd and last summer would inform the way you would present a play that's now 30 years in the past when it was first written?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, just that it would be more immediate for people. Although I think these matters, like the story of police violence against citizens is very fresh in our minds. Before George Floyd, you know, people would mark it beginning with Trayvon Martin and the beginning of the importance and popularity of the presence of Black Lives Matter. I do think that even if we had not had the explosion in the country after the murder of Floyd, people would still be coming to the theater with a sense of this question of what are we going to do about the police, you know? The Floyd murder opened a window, as you well know, which creates opportunity for many things. A reassessment of how we are, a reassessment of who has power, a reassessment of what we can and can't do and what we want to do and not do. So I think people probably come to the audience in a way that's raw, more raw perhaps, if we hadn't had to have this very tragic death of George Floyd.
I wonder if you, I'm sure you think about this, and I know I think about it in what I do, is that I'm concerned sometimes, and maybe you are too, that you're reaching the like-minded. That I don't mean preaching to the converted. It's not as simple as that. But I don't know very often whether what The New Yorker is presenting, what public radio is presenting, what you're presenting is reaching the other-minded. And because you don't want to just galvanize the like-minded, you also want to engage people with whom you're in profound disagreement, to say the least. Do you feel that that can happen with what you're doing?
I think it can. I think that it is a very hard time to do that, as you know. I mean, one of the hardest times to do it because people have so many things they can do. That's number one. Mm-hmm. They have so many ways that they can spend their time, and more power to them. So, you know, I'm not a preacher, but I think I don't mind preaching to the choir. Because I think we need choir rehearsal. That's number one.
Interesting.
And I do think that there are ways to go further. Of course,
what do you mean by choir rehearsal, Anna?
Well, I mean, I think the people who come to the theater who, first of all, I don't think the people in the theater agree or are all on the same spectrum. We think they may be tending to be more liberal. But, you know, for example, with Notes from the Field in Cambridge at the American Repertory Theater and in Berkeley, we stopped the show in the middle and sent people, the whole audience, every single night, 500 people out into groups of 20 to talk about with facilitators, you know, about the school-to-prison pipeline. People didn't agree. Believe me, they didn't agree. So much so that each time the facilitators themselves had to be taken care of because of the sort of storm of different feelings. So number one, we can do projects like that, right, which reveal what, you know, like disrupting passive observance, in this case, having people who don't know each other speaking in small groups that way. So we learn more about who we are and what we are. So that's what I mean by there's a lot of experimentation we can do. The other thing is, you know, I try to interview people who have very different opinions than myself. So let's say if I were to make a show about America right now, right, I would work with foundations to be able to build that show in a way that I weren't just thinking about who am I interviewing, Republicans and, you know, Democrats or completely disengaged people, but I would be planning for ways in communities to have people in the theater together. We need to be as creative about our audiences and about our sense of public as we are about what we put in our work. And we need to think about the people who come to engage with us in the arts or in culture in general in a way that's not just about, are they buying a ticket? They have something else that's very, very, very important to offer us right now.
Anna, we talked about what may or may not have changed politically since the first time this play saw a stage and now. What's changed in the theater? Do you feel less lonely in the theater as a Black woman, as a playwright, as an actor, which you've also been, than you might have been 30 years ago? Has much changed?
I that's a very difficult question to answer because, first of all, right now, as you know, the theater and other arts institutions are under great scrutiny by younger artists, by artists of color, and there's much that needs to be fixed. And that's one of the things that fixing, the critique, became very loud after Floyd was killed.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that more had happened, but I can't say that I walk freely in the American theater and feel that there is not racism. It would be a lie. I mean, and I feel for arts institutions and for universities to continue to claim their spaces as humanizing spaces, in large part to raise money, they really need to make some revisions and they really need to think about it. And I feel, again, it's a great thing about being a teacher. You know, my students will be much more assertive than I ever would have been. I tried to play nice. I wrote something for The Atlantic this year called The Last of the Nice Negro Girls. You know, I was a nice Negro girl. And when I went to college and then when I hit the theater, everything was written by white men. And I kind of had to smile my way into my position. And like all artists, you know, you stop smiling when you're fighting for what you think creatively is right. But, you know, I'm a hopeaholic and I really believe in these institutions and in their importance as humanizing forces. But I can't say that I feel like I belong any more than I did in the beginning. I'm happy that my work has been appreciated, but, you know, like the, you know, those old-fashioned people who say, I can't really rest until.
Anna Deavere Smith, thank you so much. The play is Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. Thank you.
Thank you.
Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992, is now at the Signature Theater in New York City. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. hurricane season on the Atlantic coast has been one of the most ruinous and expensive on record. And it's not even over, not officially, until the end of the month. For some time, staff writer Sarah Stillman has been looking at the rebuilding that comes after these storms and disasters, specifically the people who do the work. The legions of workers who show up overnight to cover blown-out buildings with construction tarp, who rip out ruined walls and floors, and who start putting cities back together. Sarah has been spending a lot of time in Louisiana with an organization known as Resilience Force.
We're in the parking lot of a Home Depot in Laplace, Louisiana, which is a suburb about 40 minutes outside of New Orleans. It's been about 2 weeks since Hurricane Ida tore through the area, and there's maybe about 100 or so workers in the parking lot, and they're all here hoping to find work rebuilding after the storm. There's also a man here named Sakatsoni.
Okay, I'm going to speak in short sentences. I'll stop and then you, yeah.
His colleague, Daniel Castellanos, is interpreting.
Okay, how is everybody? How is everybody? Okay. Just very quickly, very quickly say your names. Just very quickly.
José Oviedo.
William López.
Carlos.
Okay, welcome.
Bienvenidos.
Okay. Let me ask you this.
Quiero preguntarles algo.
How many of you have worked more than one hurricane?
¿Cuántos de ustedes han trabajado más de un huracán?
Everybody.
Los que han trabajado más de un huracán.
How many of you have worked more than two?
¿Cuántos han trabajado dos o tres?
How about five?
Over the past year, I've been following workers who rebuild after climate crises, after hurricanes and fires and floods. And I've learned so much. It is this vast, largely undocumented workforce who travel much the way that migrant workers do in agricultural work. So, you know, one season they may be doing berries and then stone fruit, and then they may be following apples. And in this case, they are following from one climate crisis to the next.
What about before that, after Hurricane Michael in Florida?
When Hurricane Ida hit this past August, this town that we're in, Laplace, was directly in its path. And about 2 weeks later, you can see row after row of houses covered in blue tarp. There's telephone lines and power lines that have fallen all over the place, uprooted trees, roofs that are completely ripped off the houses and the homes destroyed. So it is a huge amount of work to get a town up and running again. And most of the time, these are the workers who are doing it. They are cleaning up flooded buildings. They're putting blue tarp onto the rooftops. They are repairing complex electrical wiring. So, you know, when you hear about what a recovery effort really takes after a hurricane, these are the workers who are making it happen.
When you go in after a hurricane, what are the kinds of things you're rebuilding? Churches are hard, right?
The
roofs are very steep. The work you're doing after hurricanes is essential work,
right? We came with no money, we came to help, but you know, sometimes the people don't appreciate that, he said, no?
Well, we have to change that.
Eso es lo que tenemos que cambiar.
You know, where are you all sleeping?
¿Dónde están durmiendo todos?
En la calle.
Right here in the parking lot in cars, right?
Debajo del carro, under the car.
Under the cars,
yes.
In the cars.
Yes,
and in the morning you wake up, this is where you brush your teeth. This is where you get ready for work, right?
These workers are constantly on the move, and often they're sleeping in parking lots. And even though their work is tremendously urgent and really, really valuable, often these workers are not treated as if they are valued. The work is very dangerous, and they have very few protections. There's almost no regulation when it comes especially to safety on the job. There is rampant wage theft. And because so many of these workers are undocumented or have some kind of precarious legal status, they often feel like they're just not in a position to fight back when something bad happens.
Around the country, a lot of people are waking up to the idea that we have to be prepared for climate change. Well, part of the argument we're making is one of the ways we can be prepared is to protect and support the workforce. So we need infrastructure for the workers. And we need a path to citizenship for these workers. So that's the argument we've been making for a few years.
So Saket Soni, the guy you hear speaking to these workers, is truly one of the most interesting people that I've ever met in my life. He grew up in India. His dad was a civil servant, so he was moving around from Pakistan to Jamaica. He wound up going to the University of Chicago. And then he wound up, after he graduated, undocumented for a period of time. He'd messed up his immigration paperwork, and I think that really changed his sense of and deepened his understanding of what it means to be kind of living in the shadows, as he put it. So when Hurricane Katrina hit, he moved to New Orleans to do labor organizing, and he ended up doing a lot of work with people who were rebuilding after the storm, many of whom were migrant workers. And then as time went on, he noticed that it was those very same people who started to work other disasters. They went on to Baton Rouge after the flooding there. And then they went to Texas after Hurricane Harvey.
I remember pulling up to this pickup truck where a husband and wife couple were sleeping. A hurricane had just battered the Florida Keys. They woke up, they rolled down their windows, they greeted us, and they talked about their work very much as hurricane recovery work. They didn't call themselves construction workers. They didn't call themselves day laborers. They'd come from San Antonio in their truck. They had a Virgin of Guadalupe, you know, hanging from their windscreen. And, you know, they had created a whole life for themselves out of this truck as they were chasing this hurricane. And they really talked about themselves as the white blood cells of the recovery. This is a phrase I've heard from more than one worker, gathering in a place after an injury has happened and healing the wound.
So Saket and his colleagues decided to start this organization called Resilience Force. And it's basically a group that fights on behalf of these workers, both really locally and also on Capitol Hill. And Resilience Force operates a lot like a labor union. But since these workers don't have a shared collective job site, Saket and his team wind up spending a lot of time at what people call the corner, which is, you know, not a literal corner, but it's how workers and organizers refer to the parking lots at places like Home Depot all around the country where workers gather after a storm.
Roberto Saldivar. Roberto Aguilar.
Okay, so after Saket finishes talking to the workers, they start passing out these ID cards, which are little laminated Resilience Force membership cards that the workers can use to present to police or whoever they need to, and that can really help them feel more safe.
These IDs are really interesting. They're not given by a government entity. They're the membership cards of our organization. But what we're trying to do is win recognition for this rising workforce. And in the past, we've used it, you know, to win recognition from mayors, to win recognition from the police. You just heard a story of a gentleman who was pulled over by a police officer, and he presented his ID, presented himself as a resilience worker who helped rebuild Lake Charles, and the police let him go.
Oscar Perez, Oreste Guevara.
We'll come back tomorrow and day after to start training people on how to negotiate fair wages with employers and use these IDs in that negotiation.
As the morning goes on, that's when the work starts. The contractors and the homeowners, they're rolling into the Home Depot parking lot.
I'm looking for somebody that does sheetrock.
Gene Friu owns a few homes in the area that got really badly damaged in the storm. And so he drives up to the corner, and he's looking for help, looking for workers.
So I need that fixed.
Okay.
We can go look at it, and then they can give you an estimate.
That's what I want to do.
Que me dé la dirección y el teléfono para venir al rato a darle el estimado.
I don't understand, Mike.
So Saket helps Gene get set up with a worker named Leo, and Leo has brought his whole crew from Houston. So they all arrange to go together with Gene to his house for an assessment of the damage.
Oh, no, 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 no.
This is not your house. Yeah,
it is our house.
But I mean, it's you're renting it out right now. Yeah.
His wife Linda is just kind of showing the crews around.
Babe, this other wall is compromised as well.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of mold on there already. Water damage, mold. So all the sheetrock has to come out.
Mira, cuando en una casa hay mojo, todo va para afuera.
The recommendation is when you have mold, you have to take out.
So let's help you explain that to them.
Sí, hay que explicar eso, ¿no?
Pero él dijo que no.
Let's try.
Que le puede preguntar, dile que le pregunte a él para ver qué dice.
Can you ask?
Yeah, yeah, let's ask.
So usually when there is mold, we have to take out all that the ceiling.
What is it?
With the mold,
you've got enough mold in the walls and in the ceiling.
In the ceiling. Yeah.
And so the gentleman is saying that you'll have to take it all out.
That's a recommendation because it's, you know,
right.
You're going to create more mold, you know, even though when you paint, after that, they're going to be mold.
Because
yeah.
You've got mold spreading in the house.
Why you can't use the mold killer? One time in my house, and I used that mold killer, which worked.
After a little bit of negotiating, they all head to Gene's other house, which also needs repairs.
Excuse the mess. The lady's been sleeping here because she got nowhere to go. This lady's got four little ones. She's always got a baby on her hip. You can't watch four little ones and clean up at the same time. So I was hoping she'd be here today. I was going to say, you watch your kids, just tell me what you want to throw away, and I was going to clean.
You know, in terms of all the crews you could have run up into at the Home Depot, Leo and his crew are incredibly skilled. They're very talented. And it'll be important for both of you, you know, to build a direct relationship.
So that, Leo.
Yeah.
And him. He speaks English.
Yeah, we won't be around. We're not going to be here.
Yeah.
Leo's going to be leading the work.
So y'all have worked with him before?
Well, we're an organization called Resilience Force. We represent this workforce.
Okay.
And part of what we try to do is connect people like you who need the work with people like Leo. But once we leave, it's now between the two of you.
Okay.
You know, you both will be doing this together.
Okay.
Yes, first will pay you $600 to start. The other $600 when you finish.
That will pay the 2,200 up front, and then the 23 when you finish.
Okay, you guys should shake on it.
That's it, Amano.
All right, Leo.
So there's almost a kind of diplomacy in what Socket's doing here. You know, a big part of what Resilience Force tries to do is to build bonds between the workers who are doing the rebuilding and the often low-income folks who are most affected by the disasters. And often that's happening in areas that aren't particularly immigrant-friendly. So that's another key part of the context. They have to find a way to forge connections between those two groups, the workers doing the rebuilding and the people whose homes are being rebuilt. Leo and his crew stayed behind, and they get to work. And Socket and his staff wind up riding back to the Home Depot, and they start talking about the rate Leo got and basically wondering if it should have been higher.
Our role is not to
set
these kinds of rates, right?
Mm-hmm.
We are Leo's organization. We represent him. We advocate for him. We want to make sure the workplace is safe.
Right.
You know, with the kind of agreement we had today, they shook hands. You know, the numbers are on paper. It's a contract. But it's really up to him to negotiate a better price. And in this case, he probably could have. But they will treat him with respect, you know. And now they'll be here 3 days, you know. And Gene will know somebody who needs help. And Gene will introduce Leo to that person. I mean, for all we know, 2 weeks from now, he might have worked 20 homes in a one-block area.
So some of the people who hire workers are people like Gene. They're local homeowners who just need an extra set of hands. But then there's also a much bigger and more problematic story here about the corporate side of disaster recovery. So basically, as the effects of climate change have intensified, disaster relief is becoming this huge business, and I would argue a really unaccountable one. So you've got these big disaster restoration companies that are making hundreds of millions of dollars from rebuilding contracts. And increasingly, those are owned by private equity firms who see a ton of profits to be made here. But then these companies work through these really elaborate chains of subcontractors and sub-subcontractors and labor brokers. And then the workers who actually end up doing the physical work wind up with very little leverage, making very little money in what are ultimately very dangerous conditions. I spent a lot of the last year digging into the consequences of that, and you know, there's very little data out there, but what I found is that many workers are actually dying from electrocution, from falls, from bacterial infections, and they're also experiencing asbestos and silica dust exposure and a lot of potentially fatal respiratory diseases. So, you know, frankly, we're not even yet fully aware of all of the risks that these workers face.
I had a worker yesterday who told me that he had a strong intuition that he'd get sick after working a school job after Hurricane Michael. He went in and stayed in his hazmat suit too long in a school that was too hot because he was being pressured to work. Now, when he goes into really hot buildings where there's heat and moisture trapped, his hands start burning. That's 3 years later, and he's starting to feel the symptoms. It is possible to create a safer environment than the workers have, but there's just no infrastructure for them, no regulation, nowhere to complain. And because it's a completely private and subcontracted industry, it's also very hard to hold companies up the food chain accountable.
Yeah, I mean, what are some of the policy protections that you think could help now? I mean, if you could talk directly to President Biden and say, here's what needs to happen on a policy level for this labor force to be protected and to succeed and to thrive, what would you say?
Well, firstly, it's unconscionable that these workers are earning as little as $10, $11, $12 an hour. Secondly, it's unconscionable that workers are living under their cars. It would be very easy for the federal government, because so much federal money is funding this work, for them to attach a minimum wage and health and safety standards.
Oh, that seems so basic.
Yeah. It seems completely basic. And it's crazy that we don't do it. Look, right now, there is a base camp for the National Guard. FEMA officials in Louisiana are staying in hotels. But the workers who are doing the rebuilding with their hands are sleeping under their cars to protect themselves from rain.
So I spoke to more than 100 workers and experts who deal in this terrain. And there were just so many stories that stuck with me because it's so diverse, the struggles these workers face. You know, one of the stories came from Mariano Alvarado, who now works with Resilience Force.
Sí, mi nombre es Mariano Alexander Alvarado Moreno. Soy de Honduras.
So Mariano came here from Honduras, and he himself was directly affected by the climate crisis because, you know, he was a shrimp farmer, and he found that due to the changing environment there, he really couldn't make ends meet. And so he came to the U.S. He helped rebuild after Hurricane Katrina. He started working more and more storms after that. And so Socket encountered him in a really devastating situation in 2018.
Yo tuve un accidente en Panama City.
He got an accident in Panama City.
Sí, con la compañía que me llevó de aquí a mí, de una compañía de aquí de Nueva Orleans, a trabajar a Panama City.
It's a company that works here in New Orleans, and they take everybody to Panama City. These guys that were putting the blue tarp, a big storm shows up, and he falls from the top of the roof to the concrete, and he got a head break really bad. They took him inside an ambulance to the hospital, and that's where they left him.
I just want to pause on that for a second to make sure that it's totally clear. Mariano's employer basically pushed him in the middle of a rainstorm to keep working on a roof without the proper protections like a harness. And then after Mariano fell, his employer brought him to the hospital, but essentially just left him in a coma, and no one there really even knew who he was.
Sí, los doctores, cuando yo ya recordé un poco.
Well, when I started to remember a little bit, doctors started to ask for my family or my relatives, and they didn't see nobody there because I was alone. Nobody was with me.
When we first saw you, we didn't know if you would live.
La verdad que cuesta, ¿no? Porque todo lo que ha vivido uno. Y bueno.
Ya, ya. ¿Te acuerdas? You remember.
It's okay, man.
It's okay, man.
Por eso es que yo me he unido a la organización para que no siga pasando todo esto.
That's why I joined the organization, because I don't want this to happen to another person. I want to stop this.
That's a resilience force worker named Mariano Alvarado. Our story continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Supreme Court is hearing several major cases about abortion rights, including the Texas bill SB 8, which you've certainly heard about by now, and a separate challenge from the state of Mississippi. And when these cases are all finally decided, it's not at all certain that the precedent of Roe versus Wade and abortion rights in general will be left standing. Next week on our program, Gia Tolentino joins me to co-host an episode all about this turning point in abortion rights. We'll visit the last abortion clinic in the state of Mississippi, named as the defendant in the pivotal case at the Supreme Court.
I don't see us closing, but yeah, right. You know, we don't know. This is probably the first time when people ask me about it that I don't have a definite answer. Because of the fact that it's the Supreme Court and they took it, because I still can't believe it. I usually like, no, we're going to fight this today, and we're going to do this. But this time, you really don't know what's going to happen.
That's next week, and I hope you'll tune in. Now let's continue with Sarah Stillman's reporting on rebuilding workers, the people who respond to hurricanes, fires, floods, and other climate-related disasters. It's mainly a migrant workforce, largely undocumented, lacking many of the protections that are normally in place for construction workers.
As dangerous as things are on the job for resilience workers, they also face a lot of hazards outside of work. And some of these actually come from law enforcement, from the police, and from immigration enforcement. And I saw this firsthand in a different city in Louisiana, Lake Charles. And Lake Charles suffered not just one, but two major hurricanes last year. And for a while, the town really welcomed the workers. But then, you know, a few months into the rebuilding effort, the police started to crack down.
Sí, estuve un día vendiendo comida y, pues, yo y otra señora
I actually spoke to a woman named Senya, and she was selling food in the Lake Charles Home Depot last December and also doing rebuilding work herself when one day the police showed up with a drone.
No esperamos que el policía los iba a atacar por detrás.
She was out there with another lady selling food, and she never realized that, police used drones. And at that moment, she just heard someone screaming, police.
Yo le hago al camper de mi carro. Boom! Lo tranco. Me dice, I tell you, don't come again. Me dice, because you come again, te voy a dar un ticket y que nunca lo vas a olvidar. Me dice.
She got inside the car really quickly and then saw the police screaming at her. And he told her, if you come here again, I'm going to give you a ticket that you're never going to forget.
And then, so what happened after that?
Arrestaron a todas.
She said that they put them to a side and started giving them tickets, $1,500, $2,000 tickets. You know, she felt terrible that she was the only one who didn't end up getting the ticket, and all of these people never came back after that.
Wow.
You know, they're being treated as dirty rags that are disposable just because they already had covered their ceilings and everything has been already rebuilt.
I called Socket a few months ago when he was in Lake Charles, and he was trying to find a way to get the police to stop criminalizing the workers. And it's interesting, you know, since the fight on immigration reform nationally has just moved so slowly, Socket and his team, they're often left trying to improve these workers' relationships on a very local level, mayor by mayor. So when I called him, he and his team were just headed out to the corner to recruit workers for a meeting with the mayor of Lake Charles.
Hang on 1 second.
And naturally, he was not going to show up empty-handed.
Ooh, look at that wonderful yellow glow.
He's making like 20 tortilla espanola right now.
Awesome. So you're about to go deliver all of these eggs to the workers, and then what happens after that? What's the agenda?
Yeah, we'll be going to the Home Depot with 16 tortillas espanola in hand, a loaf of bread, and coffee. And later today, the mayor will be sitting down and meeting with us. I don't think he's expecting us to come in with immigrant workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And can we talk about the mayor? Like, how has there been any contact with him so far? What's that relationship like at this point as you go into this conversation today?
Well, the mayor is an avowed conservative, but we're hoping that he's practical in the face of what he has to carry out. Hurricanes, floods, and fires either make people much more ideological or much more pragmatic and practical than they've ever been about how we're going to conduct this recovery, who's going to carry it out. We've heard that before from very conservative mayors who've turned around and decided to throw their lot in with the workers. And we're hoping that Nick Hunter, this mayor, will follow suit because he needs these workers.
Hey, how you doing?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor.
I'm Nick.
Good to meet you, Mayor.
Nice to meet you. What's your name?
Socket.
Hey, Socket.
And unfortunately, the mayor's office wouldn't let our producer in to record.
I don't think we were 100% clear on what the meeting was about, and given that this is an introductory meeting.
But the mayor opens the door and greets them warmly, and then they all funnel into his office.
All right.
How are you?
I'm Nick.
So, but I think the mayor, he was good. Half an hour was not too much time to explain what happened, but I think he wanna work with us.
Lo que alcancé a ver realmente.
What I truly saw was that he is a person that seems like he's very open and willing to try to help this city and to listen to us. That's what I got from it.
I think the moment in the meeting that was the most important was when he said, the city is recovering thanks to you. And that was a significant moment, a small one, but really significant. Saul, you really jumped in and you asked for the meeting with the chief of police. It'll take more pushing to get that meeting, you know, but that's our next test, is when we can get that meeting.
So So it may seem like a meeting with the mayor is a really small step, and it is. I mean, it's one piece in this much, much larger puzzle that Resilience Force and other worker rights groups are trying to solve. But the real endgame for Socket is getting better legal infrastructure, getting stronger labor standards to protect workers. And in part, that really comes down to legislation. So, you know, for instance, Resilience Force has been working directly with members of Congress like Primla Jayapal and Joaquin Castro. Jayapal's bill would create a 2-year path to citizenship for undocumented essential workers. But frankly, most legislators have no idea about the real challenges that resilience workers are facing every day. I think about Mariano Alvarado, the man who suffered the terrible head injury in Florida. And I think about what he said that he wants lawmakers to know about his own life and the lives of his colleagues.
Para mí sería que sepan que lo que nosotros andamos haciendo, a lo mejor no lo hacemos por lo monetario, por el dinero que nos van a pagar, sino por ayudar a reconstruir la ciudad.
He wants Congress to know that these workers, what they're doing is not just about making money. They're also doing it because they really want to help rebuild these cities.
Uno ve el desastre que ha pasado, uno ve la desolación en la ciudad.
He sees what these disasters do to a city. He says, you know, the desolation that they cause, you know, how the workers are really the first ones there cleaning up and moving away the trash and helping people to return to their homes. And for Mariano, that feels like satisfaction doing that work. And that's really what he wants lawmakers to know, that these workers are performing a job that the climate crisis has rendered completely necessary for our whole collective functioning. I think we all know that these years ahead, they are going to bring more brutal hurricanes, more awful floods like the ones we recently had here in New York, more terrifying wildfires and heat waves, more than any of us is really prepared to handle. And so interdependence isn't just some far-off hypothetical thing. It's really what these workers are putting into practice every day. And what's at stake is not just these workers' fates, but also our collective shared survival.
Sarah Stillman. She's reported on labor and human rights from Mexico to Bangladesh to Afghanistan and more. And you can read all of her work at newyorker.com. And if you missed anything in our program today, you can find the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining me. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
We had additional help this week from Joe Plord, Harrison Keithline, Tegan Wendland, Betsy Shepard, Priscilla Alabi, and our old friend Rhiannon Corby.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.